Then I truly am foolish, Callicles, if I don't believe that in this city anyone at all might suffer just that, whoever he happens to be. But this much I know well. If I should ever come before a court facing danger over the sort of thing you're describing, whoever brings me in will be some wicked person, for no decent man would prosecute someone who's done no wrong, and it wouldn't be at all strange if I were put to death. Would you like me to tell you why I expect this?
By all means.
I believe I'm one of a very few Athenians, not to say the only one, attempting the true art of politics, and the only one among the men of today actually practicing it. So, since the things I say each time aren't spoken to please people, but aimed at what's best, not at what's most pleasant, and since I'm unwilling to do the clever things you recommend, I won't know what to say for myself in court. And the same argument comes back to me that I made to Polus. I'll be judged the way a doctor would be judged before a jury of children, prosecuted by a cook. Just think what such a man could say in his own defense if he were caught in that position, if someone accused him, saying, "Children, this man has done you great harm, both to you and to himself. He ruins the youngest of you, cutting and burning, and by starving and choking you, he leaves you helpless, giving you the most bitter draughts and forcing you to hunger and thirst, not like me, who feasted you on all sorts of pleasant things." What do you suppose a doctor, caught in that predicament, could find to say? Or if he told the truth, "All this I did for your health, children," how loud an outcry do you think such judges would raise? A tremendous one, wouldn't they?
Perhaps so, you'd have to assume it.
And don't you think he'd be at a complete loss for what to say?
Absolutely.
That is exactly the sort of thing I know would happen to me if I went into a courtroom. I won't be able to point to any pleasures I've provided them, the sort of thing they consider good deeds and benefits. And I envy neither the people who provide them nor those they're provided to. And if someone charges that I corrupt the younger men by leaving them at a loss, or that I slander my elders with bitter words, whether in private or in public, I'll be able to say neither the truth, that I say all these things justly, gentlemen of the jury, doing exactly what serves your interest, nor anything else. So whatever happens to come my way, I suppose that's what I'll suffer.
And does it seem right to you, Socrates, that a man should be in that position in his city, unable to help himself?
Yes, Callicles, provided he has that one thing going for him which you yourself have often agreed to, that he has helped himself by never having said or done anything unjust toward gods or men. That, we've agreed many times, is the strongest form of self-help there is. Now if someone could prove that I'm incapable of giving this kind of help to myself or to anyone else, I would be ashamed, whether refuted before many or before few, or alone before one man. And if I died from this incapacity, I would be distressed. But if I should die for lack of flattering rhetoric, I know well you would see me bear my death easily. For the act of dying itself frightens no one, unless he is utterly thoughtless and cowardly. What people fear is doing wrong. For arriving in Hades with a soul crammed full of wrongdoing is the worst of all evils. And if you like, I'm willing to tell you a story to show that this is so.
Well, since you've finished everything else, finish this too.
Listen then, as they say, to a very fine story, one you will think a myth, I imagine, though I think of it as an account, since what I am about to tell you I will tell as being true. As Homer tells it, Zeus, Poseidon, and Pluto divided up the rule between them when they took it over from their father. Now in the time of Cronos there was a law concerning men, which still holds among the gods even now, that a man who has passed his life justly and piously should, when he dies, go off to the isles of the blessed and dwell there in complete happiness, free from evils, while the man who has lived unjustly and godlessly should go to the prison of retribution and justice, which they call Tartarus. Now in the time of Cronos, and even recently while Zeus held rule, the judges of these cases were living men judging the living, and they gave their judgments on the very day the men were due to die. So the verdicts were coming out badly. So Pluto and the overseers who came from the Isles of the Blessed went to Zeus and told him that people were arriving on both sides who did not deserve to be there. Zeus said, "Well, I will put a stop to this. Right now the cases are being judged badly because," he said, "the people on trial are judged while still clothed, that is, while still alive. Many," he went on, "who have wicked souls are dressed up in fine bodies, good birth and wealth, and when the trial comes around, many witnesses come forward to testify that they have lived justly. So the judges are dazzled by all this, and besides, they themselves are judging while still clothed, having their own eyes and ears and their whole body draped as a screen in front of their soul. All of this gets in their way, both their own coverings and those of the people on trial. So first of all," he said, "we must stop them from knowing their death beforehand as they do now. This has already been arranged. Word has gone to Prometheus to put a stop to that. Next, they must be judged stripped of all these things, stripped naked, since they must be judged after death. And the judge too must be naked, dead himself, studying with his bare soul the bare soul of each person, the moment after he has died, cut off from all his kin, and having left behind on earth all that fine array, so that the judgment may be just. So having realized this before you did, I appointed sons of my own as judges, two from Asia, Minos and Rhadamanthus, and one from Europe, Aeacus. These, once they have died, will hold court in the meadow, at the crossroads from which the two paths lead off, one to the Isles of the Blessed, the other to Tartarus. Those from Asia will be judged by Rhadamanthus, those from Europe by Aeacus. And to Minos I will give the privilege of casting the deciding vote whenever the other two are in doubt about anything, so that the judgment on which road men take may be as just as possible. This, Callicles, is what I have heard and believe to be true, and from this account I reckon something like the following follows. Death, it seems to me, is nothing other than the separation of two things from one another, the soul and the body. And once they have been separated from each other, each of the two keeps very nearly the same condition it had while the person was alive. The body keeps its own nature, along with the effects of its care and its sufferings, all plainly visible. For instance, if someone's body was large, by nature or by nurture or both, while he was alive, then his corpse is large too once he has died. And if he was fat, his corpse is fat too after death, and so on for the rest. And again, if he liked to wear his hair long, his corpse has long hair too. Or if someone was a man who got whipped, and had scars on his body left by whips or other wounds while alive, you can see his body bearing these same marks once he is dead. Or if any of his limbs were broken or twisted while he lived, these same things are visible once he is dead. In short, whatever condition the body was kept in during life shows plainly after death too, either entirely or for the most part, for some time. And it seems to me the very same thing holds for the soul, Callicles. Once it is stripped bare of the body, everything is plainly visible in the soul, both its natural traits and the marks it has taken on from each pursuit the man engaged in. So when they arrive before the judge, those from Asia before Rhadamanthus, Rhadamanthus stops each of them and studies his soul, not knowing whose it is. Often, in fact, he takes hold of the great king himself, or some other king or ruler, and finds nothing sound in his soul at all, but sees it scourged and covered with scars from perjuries and injustice. Marks each of his actions has left smeared onto his soul, everything twisted from lying and pretense, nothing straight, because it was raised without truth, and he sees the soul brimming with disproportion and ugliness because of license, luxury, insolence, and lack of restraint in its actions. Seeing this, he sends it off in disgrace, straight to the place of confinement, where it is bound to go and endure the sufferings that fit it. And it is fitting for everyone undergoing punishment, if rightly punished by another, either to become better and gain from it, or to serve as an example to others, so that others, seeing him suffer whatever he suffers, may grow better out of fear. Those who benefit and pay their penalty at the hands of gods and men are the ones whose wrongs are curable. Still, the benefit comes to them through pain and suffering, both here and in Hades. There's no other way to be rid of injustice. But those who have committed the worst wrongs and have become incurable because of such crimes, these become the examples. They themselves no longer gain anything, being incurable, but others gain. Those who see them suffering the greatest, most painful, and most frightening punishments forever, for their sins, hung up there in the prison of Hades quite literally as examples, a sight and a warning for whichever wrongdoers arrive there from time to time. Archelaus, I say, will be one of these if Polus is telling the truth, and so will any other tyrant of his kind. And I think most of these examples turn out to have come from tyrants, kings, rulers, and men who have managed the affairs of cities, since it is people with power who commit the greatest and most impious crimes. Homer bears this out too. It is kings and rulers he has shown suffering eternal punishment in Hades, Tantalus, Sisyphus, and Tityus. But the Recites, or any other ordinary man who was wicked, no one has shown bound in great torments as incurable, I suppose because it wasn't within his power to do such things. That's exactly why he was better off than those who did have the power. But of course, Callicles, it is from among the powerful that the truly wicked come, though nothing stops good men from arising among them too, and it is well worth admiring those who do. For it is hard, Callicles, and deserves great praise, for a man who has had great scope to act unjustly to live his life justly instead. Few such men appear, though both here and elsewhere, I think, there have been and will be fine and good men possessing this excellence. The excellence of managing justly whatever is entrusted to them. One in particular has become quite famous even among the rest of the Greeks, Aristides' son of Lysimachus. But most powerful men, my good friend, turn out badly. So, as I was saying, whenever Rhadamanthus gets hold of one of these, he knows nothing else about him, not who he is nor from what family, only that he is wicked. And seeing this, he sends him off to Tartarus, marking him as either curable or incurable, and once there he suffers what is fitting. But sometimes, seeing another soul that has lived piously and truthfully, that of a private citizen or anyone else. Most of all, I would say, Callicles, a philosopher who has minded his own business and not meddled in everything during his life. He is struck with admiration and sends it off to the Isles of the Blessed. Aeacus does the same, each of these two holds a rod as he judges, while Minos sits overseeing them, alone holding a golden scepter, as Odysseus in Homer says he saw him, holding a golden scepter, giving judgments to the dead. As for me, Callicles, I am persuaded by this account, and I take care to present my soul to the judge as healthy as possible. So setting aside the honors that most men value, and practicing truth, I will try as best I can to live and, when I die, to die, as good a man as I am able to be. And I urge everyone else as far as I can, and I urge you especially in return to choose this life and this contest, which I say is worth more than all the contests here. And I reproach you for the fact that you will not be able to help yourself when the judgment and trial come, the one I was just now speaking of. But when you come before that judge, the son of Aegina, and he seizes you and brings you to trial, you'll gape and reel with dizziness there just as much as I would hear, and someone will very likely strike you across the face, without any regard for your dignity, and treat you like dirt in every way. Perhaps all this sounds to you like an old wives' tale, something to be dismissed with contempt, and it would be no wonder if you did dismiss it, if we had somewhere else found better and truer things to say. But as it stands, you can see that the three of you, you and Polus and Gorgias, who are supposed to be the wisest men in Greece today, cannot show that one ought to live any life other than this one, the very life that turns out to be advantageous even down there. No, out of all these arguments, though everything else has been refuted, this one claim alone stands unshaken, that doing wrong is something to guard against far more than suffering it, and that above everything else a man must practice not seeming good but being good, both in private and in public life. And that if anyone becomes bad in some respect, he must be punished for it, and that this becoming, through punishment, someone who pays what he owes is the second best good after being just to begin with, and that every kind of flattery, whether aimed at oneself or at others, whether at the few or at the many, is something to flee from, and that rhetoric, like every other pursuit, must always be used in the service of justice. So listen to me and follow me to where, once you arrive, you will be happy both in life and after it, as this argument shows. Let anyone who wants to despise you as a fool and treat you shamefully, let him do it. And by Zeus, let him even strike that disgraceful blow and take it bravely. You'll suffer nothing terrible if you are truly a good and admirable man, one who practices virtue. And then, once we have practiced this together, only then, if it still seems right, shall we turn to public affairs, or to whatever else seems best to us, and deliberate about it then, once we are better equipped to deliberate than we are now. Because it is shameful, given the condition we plainly find ourselves in at present, to go on acting the bold young man as though we were somebody, we, who never agree with ourselves twice about the same things, and that on the most important matters of all. That is the depth of ignorance we have sunk to. So let us take as our guide the argument that has just now come to light, which shows us that this way of living is the best, to live, and to die practicing justice and every other virtue. Let us follow this then, and let us call on others to follow it too, not that other argument, the one you trust in and by which you keep calling on me. For that one, Callicles, is worth nothing at all.